Hey, readers and writers. Welcome to episode 118 of Read and Write. Today, we're talking about children's literature with our guest, Rivka Hodgkinson. She's a writer and reviewer of children's literature, and her most recent work is Ducky's Bath Time, a mindfulness coloring storybook. You can find her on Facebook and Twitter at Meet Rivka. So hi, Rivka. Tell me about Ducky's Bath Time. What drove you to create it?
Yeah, so Ducky's Bath Time is a fun little story about a gender non-binary duck named Ducky who has had a long, busy day and just wants to relax. So I was working with our illustrator, Ashley D'Amico, and she has a couple of littles and I have a couple of littles. And I think often we have this idea of self-care and meditation and mindfulness and de-stressing is something parents need, but kids need it just as much. They're forming millions of neurons in their brain every single day. And so we really just talked about how we want to teach our kids from when they're really tiny to take that time to be mindful of their surroundings, tune into their senses. What are they feeling? What are they hearing? What are they seeing? What are they smelling? And so this was just taking an everyday event, bath time, that we all do with our kids on a semi-regular basis, depending on, you know, the whole, there's this whole celebrity fiasco right now, but, you know, to have that opportunity to teach our kids through that very sensory experience to tune into what's around them. And so it's a coloring book so kids can get involved with the story and color it. There are questions on each page that can help guide parents in teaching that those mindfulness practices to their kids. And it's just a really fun little story. So my two-year-old, who has no concept of the fact that I wrote it, still asks me to read it at least once a day. So
That's got to be like the best type of, like, I want to say criticism, but it's not, like, the best kind of review is your own kid loving it and wanting to read it over and over again.
It's been interesting to me and funny to see what part she really likes the best. And mm-hmm. Like, oh, you really like it when the bubble gets bigger, 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 pop. Like, she laughs every time.
That sounds like exactly what my four-year-old would love the most. The thing exploding.
Yes. Exactly.
So what got you started in children's literature? I mean, how did you start? When did you start? Have you always loved it? Was it when you had kids?
I have always loved children's books. So I taught myself to read by the time I was four. Whoa. And have just loved books ever since then. I literally cannot remember a time when I wasn't reading and enjoying reading. I think as for me as a kid, books were my favorite and best escape. I was definitely that nerdy child who would much rather hole up in a corner with a book than go run around and play soccer.
I think on this podcast, we were all that kid.
Yeah,
we all identify.
Exactly. And I'm also the oldest of 11 siblings. So there was never really...
11 siblings.
Yes. Yeah, my youngest sister is only 4 years younger or 4 years older than my oldest child. And so there was never this point in time where I kind of like outgrew picture books. Mm-hmm. And obviously I moved on to other things, but I've continuously been reading picture books my entire life. And I just love the genre. I love the conversations that it opens. I love the pictures. I love the cadence of the words, like everything. A really good children's book to me still is a reading pleasure that I enjoy even as an adult. And definitely when I read to little kids, to just see those aha moments, those moments of wonder and connection and learning happening in real time is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I love it when I read to my kids. I love it when my husband reads to my kids because he's better at the voices than I am. I like watching. They're like, take the pout fish, for example. I mean, it's just, it's so fun because they get to say certain lines and just watching their faces as somebody reads a story to them is just awesome. I don't know. Maybe that's just a mom point of view, but. I love that.
It is adorable when you are lucky enough to have a father involved with your kids that is really involved in there. And that's definitely one of the sweetest things for me too. You know, for me, my husband doesn't read to my daughter as much, but when they're both like laying on the floor coloring is pretty adorable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got that. I actually don't read the nighttime story to my kids all that much, just because due to his schedule and my schedule, like, he works all day. So I say, basically say, after dinner is like daddy kid time until bedtime. Right. And I got them the rest of the day. You get that time. Yeah. So I don't do much that bedtime reading.
Yes.
So it's always fun to watch it.
Well, I'm really excited. My oldest is going to be turning 14 next month. And even my preteen teen boys still enjoy me reading to them at night. Like, that's just part of our...
That feels really lucky. I'm not sure my kids would still like me to read to them when they're 14.
I mean, obviously, I don't read picture books to them anymore. You know, we've read The Hobbit, and we've read several different fantasy series, and I've read some nonfiction to them, and it's just a great time to expand their world and have big conversations and have that quiet time together. We actually built our house, and when we built our house, I made sure all the boys' bedrooms had the doors open to one central hallway location for the explicit purpose of being able to sit there and read to them. So we'll see how long we can keep that going. But as of right now, they're still very excited to have me read
that. That sounds very lucky. And I hope it continues for as long as you can make it go. What are you reading right now?
Right now we are reading book 7 of the Septimus Heap series by Angie Sage. She's a UK author that writes fantasy and other things too, I think. But we have all loved the story. I will say, now that we're on book 7, I'm kind of ready to move on to the next series, because it's just been a lot of books. reading. I think all of COVID, we've been reading the Septimus Heap series. But it's a really interesting storyline and has some unique elements. You know, fantasy genre can sometimes be a little redundant, as far as they use a lot of the same tropes and things like that.
They tend to capitalize on the mainstream ideas.
Exactly. But she does a really good job of bringing in, you know, some unique things and unique elements that I haven't seen in other fantasy literature. And she does a great job with the character development and showing these kids who are about the same age as my boys kind of growing and developing over time and being faced with hard choices and hard challenges and having to figure out how to navigate those choices. And so we're enjoying it a lot. But
that, I have to admit, that's kind of my blind spot right now. Like, I like adult fiction and I like young adult fiction. And I am reading, have read baby and toddler and now young children books. But that particular area, like the young K, first grade, I don't know, that particular genre that Amazon tends to group them by, I can't remember what it is now. But that's my blind spot right now. I don't have any experience in that. I don't read it. I haven't read it. So I'm actually looking forward, because I keep seeing titles and I keep adding them to like a kid's library wish list. Buy later.
Well, I will say, like, one thing, I mean, I read The Hobbit to the boys. We've read The Hobbit, I think, at least 3 or 4 times. And I think the first time we read it, they were 3, 4, and 5. So they were obviously far too small to really understand fully what was happening. But I'm a big proponent of, mix it up, read things that are way above your child's reading level, because it exposes them to vocabulary, to the sounds of language, to the flow of longer, more complex sentences. You know, don't only read that stuff. Like, usually if I read something heavier, we'll read something really light afterwards.
You're making me want to I started reading my daughter The Last Unicorn, and you're making me want to pick it back up and try it again, because she loves unicorns and she loved the story, but I don't think she was grasping what was happening. But now I'm thinking maybe I should delve back into it and just go for it.
You know, and it's, I think it improves their reading level, their language level. You know, actually one that you might really like, though, that is kind of more that younger ish it's been called the American Winnie the Pooh. It's a series of books written, I think, in like the 60s and 70s, called Freddy the Pig. And they're a little on the more advanced side of what would be considered an early reader, but with way better storyline.
Okay. I feel like I might have seen a title, something about that. We just actually this week we went and the kids got their first library cards this week.
Yeah.
And so we were tooling around the kids section and I feel like I saw something like that on an end cap.
Yeah. The one we have that we read most recently is Freddy Goes to Florida. And it's basically all the animals in the barnyard decide that they don't like winter anymore. So they're all going to migrate and they're all going to go to Florida. So it's all of the farm animals and their adventures and misadventures traveling as this big group of farm animals down to Florida. And it's just fun and silly and, you know, a story that even your kids could follow along with the storyline, but it's just that little bit. They couldn't read it on their own, right? It's just that little bit more advanced.
Well, yeah, my kids can't technically read yet. My oldest is, we've got her like the reading age books where it's like, we actually, we have the classic Dick and Jane. We have those.
That's funny.
Some of those. But yeah, like we have those books right now because they can't read themselves yet at all.
That's fun. That's still fun though. And you know, when you read with them, it helps them with all of those skills. Mm-hmm. And so I do think like there is, as soon as kids can read alone, I hear a lot of parents acting like they can't read aloud to their kids anymore because they're old enough to do it by themselves. And to me, reading is about so much more than just reading. It's about sharing an experience, sharing a world together.
I 100% agree with that. Like as a writer and as a reader, I fill my house with books and I want my kids to experience all these worlds that I've experienced. Like I've gone so far as people have gotten them older books for like their future library. And I've read them because I want to be able to explain to them, like if they ask a question, like, oh yeah, this was great. And I liked this part about it. Like I want to be able to experience it with them and I want them to experience what I've experienced.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting because like I have a very vast library of print books. And a lot of people come to my house and they see all my books. And after they're like, oh my gosh, that's so many books. You know, they're like, why would you have that many books when we have libraries and we have the internet and we have, you know, and like.
Okay. First of all, everybody on the podcast understands why you have a house full of books because we all have housefuls of books.
Well, and let me give like one more thing. Even a lot of readers don't necessarily think about this is to me, for my kids, even if it's something I won't read again, which is unlikely, but could happen because there's so many books to read, period. Right. You can never read it. It's
all and I've picked up a few at like Barnes and Nobles. I read once like, okay, that was good. I don't need to read that again, but I own it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yep. But for me, it's the art of discoverability. So we live in an algorithm based world that's constantly feeding my kids what it thinks they want to read, and they are searching for things on Google, and Google is this giant repository of all the information in the world, but you can't find it if you don't know what you don't know. You can't find it if you don't know what you're looking for, if you don't know what search terms to put in. And for me, having a library is the same experience that I had when I was a kid going into my grandma's library, you know, picking up things like Freud's Introduction to Psychoanalysis when I was 13, which I would not recommend for a 13-year-old for the record. But being able to find and discover things that I had no context for, never heard of, would never have thought to look for on my own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have that possibility to just browse the shelves and discover things that they have no current context for, that no algorithm is ever going to deliver to them. Mm-hmm. So that's my big reason for having a physical library is the art of discovery.
It's a very nice reason. My reason is just I like books. I have a minor addiction to books.
That's
to stories.
That's also true. I saw a Facebook meme one time that was like, you know, you have a great spouse or whatever when he says things like, no, of course that's not too many books. Sure, we'll just build a new shelf.
I have a wonderful husband then. My husband is a book enabler. I'll be like, I put 12 books in my Amazon cart. Which ones should I get? He's like, get them all. And I'm like, that doesn't help, but thank you.
Yeah, no, Josh, my husband will just be like, okay, well, we'll just build a new shelf. I'm not sure where anymore. But we've gone so far as I've considered whether we can build full pull down shelves in the ceiling rafters in the basement.
I've seen those. And actually, my husband pointed out to those, like, look, you could put more books in those. He pointed it out to me and said that, nice. That I could, you could pull it down and store books in there. And I was like, yeah, but our house is so short. Where would we put it? We'd hit our heads on it.
I have not seen it. So now I'm going to have to go look up plans
I'll have to see if I can. It was like this, I think they were marketing it towards like people who had apartments in large cities that didn't have a lot of space and probably tall ceilings. We live in a weird mid-century house that's very short. It doesn't have tall ceilings. So it wouldn't work for us. But it was literally like something like you pull down. It was like this big open box in the ceiling. That's and you just store things in there. Like the advertisement had a yoga mat in there, but we would totally use it for books in this case.
Absolutely. Like why would you do anything else?
I'm actually running out of book space. I think I might have said this on a different episode, but I've got books in front of books, on top of books, and in piles.
Yeah.
I have run out of bookshelf space. I have to find more shelving for my bookshelf, for my book. And the whole reason we bought this house is because it had a bunch of built-in bookshelves. And I filled them up. I filled them up to bursting, literally.
Yeah.
They're bowing under the weight.
So we have this little weird area above the laundry room that had extra space that we built a platform across. So it's this little loft. We enclosed it with a railing. We built a little step ladder up there. And it's great because it's got all these shelves. And it's this comfy little spot. We've got beanbags up there. But now, like, there's literally only room for the beanbags because everything around is all books, and there's books piled on all the steps all the way up, so there's only like half of the space to go up the ladder, because I'm just like, I'm gonna have to do something about this.
Sounds like you have a problem. It's a nice problem to have, but it sounds like you have a problem.
Exactly. You know I don't think it's a problem. I think the problem,
I say that
is
because society tells me I should say that, right? I don't think it's a problem either. I love books.
Yeah.
I would much rather have the physical copy of a book than an e-copy of a book. Although I definitely buy like the Kindle versions and I just download the e-books because that's instantaneous. I don't have to wait to go somewhere to get it or have it arrive to me. That's my instantaneous read, but I like having a physical copy. There's something nice about that. Yeah. And if you can find it used, it has that weird used book smell, all the better.
Mm-hmm. No, it was funny because one of my kids' friends, I had a series of books that I had the whole series, but I only had them soft cover. And then I saw a hardcover of one of them at the bookstore for in like the bargain shelf or whatever for $5 or something. So I grabbed it and I came home. I was like, look, I got this book in hardcover. And their friend looked at me, don't you already have that book? I was like, yes, I do, but only in soft cover. And they're like, but I'm very confused. You already have that book. I'm like, yes, but only in soft cover. I don't understand where the question is here.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I have lost count of the number of Handmaid Tales I have and The Last Unicorn. I've mentioned it and I'm a big fan of it. I don't know how many copies I have of either of those books because I just keep obsessively buying them for different covers.
Yeah, it's true. Well, in some books, if I really like it and I see it as a good deal, I'll buy it because I give them away, you know, like people will be like, anytime somebody asks me for a referral for a book, well, I like this kind of book, or I like this kind of book, or I want a book about this. I'll be like, okay, you should read this one. So that's definitely my go-to birthday present too for anybody. And it's great because even if I forget their birthday till like the day before,
you already have it
on Prime, right? Well, usually I'll order it because then it ships it right to them. I don't even have to go to the mailbox, right?
Yeah, I'm constantly, of the people around me that like to read, which physically around me isn't that much, but
that's sad.
The ones that do like to read, I'm constantly giving them books for like presents, like Christmas time, yes. Here's four. I know you're going to love these.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I discovered that there's a thing called a Gaylord of books. This definitely grew my collection greatly, but you can find places that will sell pallets of books that are like extras that didn't get sold off the clearance rack, or like just used books or from estate sales or whatever.
Are they all like different books or is all the same versions?
All different books. So it's just, in some places they're a lot easier to find. Like you can go on eBay and look. I'm feeding people's addiction right now. This is going
I'm like, bad, but, send me the link. I need to find this.
You can go on eBay if you look for a Gaylord of books, or if you go on Facebook Marketplace, you can. I had my in-laws contacting me and was like, hey, there's this big box of books at the auction. Like anywhere.
I'm literally writing this down.
Like $50 to $250. And we got it, and I think there was like 3,000. I paid $50, and there was like 3,000 books in there.
3,000 books. Oh my God. And I don't have room for 3,000 books.
Not all of them were ones I was interested in, but enough of them that it made it very worthwhile. And then I just like
donate them to your local library.
I donated a bunch. I gave some gifts. I sold some of them more. Like rare ones on eBay. I definitely recouped my cost many times over. So now I'm like always on the lookout for buying.
I will now be too. I didn't know this existed.
I know. It's great. It's dangerous, but also wonderful.
Yeah, some of the weirdest, best place. Oh, we're totally off track now. We will eventually get back to children's literature. But some of my favorite places to get those weird used books is just like the thrift store, like the Salvation Army. Like people are all, I don't know why people give away books, but people are always giving away books. And sometimes there's like that wonderful rare one. They're like, oh, yes, I need this book in my life. And then you buy it for like a cent.
It's so true.
It's great.
So true. Especially children's books. So we'll try to redirect back.
Yes.
There's this lovely little used bookstore called the Blue Stocking Bookshop in Holland, Michigan, near where I live. And she always has like a fantastic selection. And whenever I go, I have to look through the children's books and see if there's any I don't have.
I look forward to going back to my favorite used bookstore. I thought we'd be able to go, but then like the Delta variant started getting up again. Yeah. So now we're just like, we're back kind of a little bit in hunker mode. So they're going to school and I don't feel comfortable taking them to another town to use books. I don't know. It sounds dumb saying it out loud, but
sound dumb at all. I mean, I feel kind of the same way because like in our household, we have kids going to three different schools, and so it's kind of like, well, that's pretty much like our maximum exposure I feel comfortable with. So since school has started, we've really stopped doing a lot of other things just because it's just too much,
too many variables,
right? You know, especially with two of mine being, you know, my 11-year-old and my 2-year-old are too young. So
I'm in that same boat. Four and five can't get a vaccine, so
So, you know, that's why, again, we have big libraries, so it's okay. Like, we never run out of things to read, if nothing else. Like, toilet paper maybe, but.
What's your favorite children's book to read?
Oh, my goodness. I should have known you were going to ask me that.
Yeah, this was a predictable question, totally.
It was, but it's like, can I do top 10?
Yeah, you can totally do top 10. I actually have a list of in Google Docs here of my favorites, and it's like, I don't know, 7-8 long.
Yeah. Well, I will say, okay, so I will say this on children's books, because I love children's books. Probably children's books alone, I think I have about 1,500. So it's really hard to narrow it down. And I feel like my favorite children's book is the one that best meets the moment. That's what I'm going to say. Because, you know, they're different children's books are for different things. Like, I love Sandra Boynton, Moo Ba La La La. It's such a silly, fun book that's great for real, real littles. And my oldest, when he was like 2 years old, we had that whole book memorized. And we would just drive in the car, even if I had nothing else to distract him with, we would just like recite Moo Ba La La La. So that's like,
she's great, by the way. I have two of her books on my favorite list.
Yeah, so fun. Mo Willems is another one of those, you know, just really fun, really silly books. But then there's also, you know, there are books that are great to expand kids' minds and understanding of the world. Like Sarah Stewart's The Gardener is one that I love. And it's like about this girl during the Depression era who goes to live with her very grumpy uncle and like plants this flower garden. And it's just, it's told in the format of letters back and forth between her and her family.
This sounds amazing. I'm going to have to get this book.
It is. It's just the illustrations are beautiful and it's such an interesting book, you know. And of course, then there's ones that deal with topical things, whether it be like Chris Ferry's STEM series, like the Astrophysics for Babies. That one's where I have learned science facts from Chris Ferry's toddler board books, you know, or really important, helping your small child even have a context for bigger picture issues about the anti-racist baby board book, or, you know, introducing new foods to them. The Food Network has a book called A is for Artichoke that has all these different foods. So that one is super fun. So I'm really about finding the book that's the right fit for the child and helping develop their language skills or develop their understanding of the world. Or, you know, another one that I love is The Ugly Vegetables by Grace Lin. And it's about this little Chinese American girl who all of her neighbors are planting flowers and her mom is planting really ugly vegetables. Yuck, like who wants vegetables? And then at the end of the story, her mom makes this beautiful traditional Chinese stew and the smell like brings all the neighbors and they all bring flowers and try some.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah, it's this great story about community and about embracing differences and understanding, you know, that people come from different places and have different ideas, and that tension we sometimes have with our parents of like, you don't know what's cool.
Right.
So, and like those are a lot of the ones that come to mind immediately off the top of my head. But there's just so many more. I mean, this is part of the reason why I started writing book reviews. So like my site, beautifulbooksforchildren.com, and there's bunches of reviews about books that I love and talking about what I like about them and suggesting activities to do along with the books and all of that kind of fun stuff.
Activities to go along with books. I love doing, especially if we have like a rainy day and I'm just kind of like, what do we do? Like I grab them. Like my favorite one is the Very Hungry Caterpillar. Yes. And, you know, his style of art. We make our own caterpillars kind of in the same style. Like we paint a picture and then we cut the picture up and then we glue it together. Like I love interactive things like that.
Yeah.
Like that are like the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like my son is going to pre-K, it starts on Thursday, and the teacher sent home the stuff and they're going to read the Kissing Hand. I think it's the Kissing Hand. The two raccoons, the one who's scared to go away to school, so his mom gives him a kiss on his hand. And so she sent home a piece of paper and said, you know, trace your hand and put a kiss on it, and we're going to surprise the kids at the end with your mom's kiss. Which sounds so sweet. I mean, I love those interactive, like especially art projects that go along with books. I feel like it just ties it home.
Yep. Annie's Astronaut is another really cute one. It's about this little girl that wants to be an astronaut when she grows up. And she's like preparing for a career day. I mean, anything from Reading Rainbow, right? Like,
right.
I loved Reading Rainbow when I was a kid. There's just so many. I mean, I could just keep going for, it's probably not even my top 10. I'm sure if I were to go out and look at my bookshelf, I would be like, oh, but wait, this one.
Right. Yeah. I know. Cause now I'm thinking about, we have like the Annie the Riveter, the ones, or somebody, the architect, Iggy the Architect, those that show like, especially with my daughter, who's all about princesses, we're really trying to push, you could be an engineer, you could be president, you know, like the other, anything other than princess right now, we're just kind of shoving it at her. Just get exposed.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the great things about children's books is there isn't really boy books and girl books, you know, there's just books and stories.
Right.
And the more that we can encourage kids with that idea from a very young age. Oh, Chrysanthemum. There's another one of my favorite ones by Kevin Hankey. Mm-hmm. I love that book. My kids have unusual names, and so that was a great one for them when they were little, just like embracing their names and who they were. I could talk about
books. You know, I said that was my blind spot, but as you're talking, I'm remembering some of those books I kind of read maybe 11, 12-ish, and I'm like, wow, I can't wait to read that book to my kids. Like, I don't remember half the titles though. So I'm going to have to like dig through my parents' library to find these books and bring them home. Like there was one, oh, The Indian in the Cupboard. There's one. Yeah. I can't wait to read that one. I don't remember if it was good, but I remember liking it. So I don't know.
I know. That's always the hard thing, right? Like some of these things you go back and you're like, why didn't I like this book? Like, right. But you know, so a lot of them do stand the test of time. Some not so much, but a lot of them do. Mm-hmm. But
like there was this series from like, I think it was like from the 50s or 60s that I stumbled upon in like a Scholastic Book of the Month club when I was a preteen. There was something about like a silver coin that was magical. And I'm saying all these things that you don't have any idea what I'm talking about. But I can't wait to go back and look these things. But I remember loving them. Like this girl had a magic coin, and when it rained, it turned into an umbrella. Or it took them back to pirate times. They're very short, so I'm sure my kids will love them. But wow, I'm really looking forward to these. Listeners, I will look up the titles and put them in the show notes in case you're interested.
Well, I should put all of the people listening on a mission. There's one children's book I remember from when I was a little kid that I cannot remember the title of the book. I can see the pictures in my head. But unfortunately, Google cannot yet do a Google image search scanning my brain to see what
that would make things so much easier if they could just access our memory. But that sounds scary saying it out loud.
Yes, I know, right? and I cannot find it. I cannot remember enough of it to search for it to see even what it is. But it was like it was an adaptation of a, I believe, Russian folktale that was about this little girl named Eliza who. I forget exactly what she wanted, but she wanted somebody to come and stay or somebody to come sleep there or something. And so every part of the story would be like, well, where is the donkey going to sleep? And then the donkey's going to sleep in such and such bed. And it kept adding this repeating phrase of like, do Eliza do. That's all I can remember of the story. I want to find this book so badly. Okay. And I've looked up all the things that I can remember in every iteration I can think of in a Google search, and I can't find anything remotely similar. And I'm like, I know this book exists. It's not just in my head.
Right.
So if any of you have read a Russian folktale about a little girl who wants somebody to stay over and they keep moving all the animals to different beds and daddy ends up sleeping in the horse's bed or something like that. I want to know what this book is.
Well, we will get on it. I will even put my own efforts towards the Google search and try to find this do Eliza do.
Yeah but no, because it's funny how we carry these memories, you know, and we just remember bits and pieces. I sometimes think about that with my own kids, like what they're going to remember from me reading to them,
right? Because then you try to remember what you remembered at that time. And
yeah. But I mean, saying that, like, I remember, I think I was 5, maybe 6, but I think I was 5. And my dad read aloud to us The Walk West and Walk Across America, which were these books about this Peter something. But he basically was this hippie in the 60s who was all disillusioned with the world and so just walked across the entire U.S.
It sounds like Forrest Gump. Did Forrest Gump parody
it? I don't know. This was before Forrest Gump, so I don't know. But I remember a lot from those books, and I was pretty little. And looking back, it's kind of like that was, you know, pretty advanced topic, you know, subject matter. Right. But I was fascinated by the concept. So
that sounds awesome. My clearest memory was a bit older. I was like, I think it was second grade, so maybe 7, 8. Mm-hmm. And I secretly stayed up all night long to finish like one of the Little House on the Prairie books.
Oh yeah.
Like nobody knew I did it, but I stayed up all night to read this book.
I loved the Laura Ingalls Wilder books when I was a kid, and I've read them to my kids, and I also really love the Chronicles of Narnia, and I was always just so hopeful that I would open a door and end up somewhere else.
I'm actually speaking of going back to a little bit of book buying, I am on a mission to find the Chronicles of Narnia series as I remember it, the covers that I remember from the 90s that were like kind of paper arty. I don't know. I'm on a mission. I found a few on ThriftBooks, but I haven't completed my collection yet. But yeah,
all right. Well,
I'm super excited to read the Chronicles of Narnia to them. What's that?
Yeah. You'll have to tell me which ones you're still looking for. And I'll keep my eyes open and say.
I've got pictures. I can post them on the website. And like, hey, if you see this, let me know where it is.
Right? Exactly.
I don't know why I'm being very specific about the cover art.
Well, it makes a difference, you know. Mm-hmm.
And if you start the series in that same cover art, I want the I'm just anal enough that I want the rest of the series to be in the same cover art style.
Well, that's with the Septimus Heap series that we're reading right now. I don't think they printed book 7 as a hardcover. Like, Angie Sage, if you're listening to this, I need the hardcover of book 7.
That would annoy the hell out of me.
Yes, I have books 1 through 6 as a hardcover, and they're not traditional 6x8 sizing. They're more like square and small. Uh-huh. So they're really interesting, like how they look. And I have 1 through 6 all in the hardcover, and then 7 is the soft cover. And I'm just like, this is not okay. Mm-hmm. But I'm not clear that a hardcover was printed for this book. I can't find any evidence that one exists.
I used to do something similar, like when Harry Potter was still being released, even towards the end, I was done reading it. Like at that time, I just couldn't handle any more Harry Potter, but I still bought the books because I knew enough about myself that I would be annoyed at myself if I didn't have all the books in my collection, if they weren't all in the same style. So even though I wasn't reading them, I still bought them and put them on my shelf. I did go back and finish them. So there's that.
Yeah. Well, and I love creating like reading traditions with my kids too. So in addition to like reading at night, like always in December, we read for our read aloud, we read The Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens.
Yes. Yeah, we do the same thing. Dad reads it Christmas Eve, like a big classic fancy version of it. Yeah. Yes, yeah. I'm all about that too. I understand.
And that's one of the books that you mentioned having like so many copies. I have so many copies of Christmas Carol. And that was one of the books that was in that Gaylord of books. It's this hardcover illustrated beautiful edition with like a green cover, but it's printed in the front. It was a special printing for some factory that they gave to their workers for Christmas in like 1950 something.
That's amazing.
So I was like, there are not a lot of these in the world. I can tell you right now.
Yeah.
So that's probably my most fun copy of Christmas Carol, just because it's just so unique. But
yeah, there's a our copy of The Night Before Christmas, the poem that we read is that's the one I refuse to buy another copy of because I want that copy to be special. And actually, maybe I should buy 2 copies so the kids could take them. I'm thinking about this out loud now. When they get older, maybe have 2 so they could divide it. I don't know. Yeah. Otherwise, it'll just be this one copy.
It's a problem. Like, so there is a book. My mother is Jewish, so we do celebrate both Christmas and Hanukkah in our family. And so there is a book that I got originally at the library called The Hanukkah Bear that I thought was the greatest story ever. And I loved it. And then I bought a copy and it was like a later edition and they changed the story. And it's not, it's like awful. In a very subtle little way, but it's, I know, right? like, why did you? So now I've got to find an older version of the Hanukkah Bear because I was like, this isn't
right. That's really, I feel pain with that. Why would they do that?
Yeah. I don't know why. It didn't, and it's not even like it's an old enough book that it's like, oh, this is a 50-year-old story or something.
Right.
You know, it's like, this isn't that old of a book. There was no need to do that. Change the story.
Publishers. I'm blaming it on the publisher.
Yeah.
Because clearly the author wouldn't have changed it on purpose.
Right. Well, one would help.
I have a couple questions I wanted to get through.
What
did you do? What do you do to improve yourself in writing and, I guess, reviewing kids' books? What do you do to help yourself either improve writing or just improve yourself in the business of writing?
Yeah. So I would say reviewing and editing books, I definitely have to put a very different hat on than I do for writing. Like, I have to really conscientiously switch my brain into those different modes.
As like far you're as, out of creative into analytical?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Kind of switch from left brain to right brain, I guess, would be the best analogy. But as far as how do I improve myself, I do think reading makes a really big difference, but I think conscientious reading, right? So there is a style of reading that we do just as a consumer, and then there is a style of reading that we do as a creator to observe with more detail. What are they doing here? Like, why was that made me laugh or that made my child laugh? Why? What was it about it that made it funny? Was it the sound? Was it the position in the story? Was it because it went back to something else? I think also just reading broadly and widely around a wide range of types and styles of children's books is important to see what works, what doesn't work. Do you like, what do you not like? But then to ask that question, why don't I like this? I think is really important. Understanding, I'm always trying to learn about neurology, behavioral science, psychology. How are our brains processing what we read? So I would say to me, that's another really influencing factor, is saying what happens in a child's brain when we read, what happens in our brains when we read, and doing as much research as I can on a regular basis.
This sounds like a whole nother podcast episode.
It's so fun. Like, and that actually started because my oldest, when he was 9 months, had a massive stroke and had complete left-sided paralysis. And the neurologist who looked at his brain scan said, this is like the worst pediatric stroke I've seen. There's such a huge area of his brain that's damaged. And we don't know if he'll ever walk or if he'll ever talk or if he'll ever use the left side of his body. And when I tell people this who have met my almost 14-year-old, they're in shock because he's just a very normal 14-year-old kid.
I'm glad. Yes.
Yeah.
I was very scared there for a second.
Yeah. But that was what really launched me off, you know, when he had that stroke. It's that I have to understand everything I possibly can about how the brain works and what I can do to help his brain be as plastic as possible and help him to learn as much as possible and use both sides of the body and all the things. So that's kind of what launched me off on it. But I realized so much of how we perceive the world is related to how our brain works. And if we want to improve our perception, we have to understand what's under the hood, so to speak. You know, we can't just learn how to drive the car. Learn how to change the oil and how to replace the air filter and like why it runs the way it does.
You make me feel silly because I don't do any of those things in my car.
I'm sure someone does, right? Like that.
Yeah, somebody does. You know, that's not how my brain works, though.
Yeah, it's, you know, that needs to be done. That's half the battle. But so for me, that's definitely something that I apply to my writing is whatever level of writing or reading or review I'm doing is like, what is this doing in our brain when we read this, and how can we write with that in mind? So I don't know if that answers the question.
It does, and it also brought to mind something I hadn't consciously realized about myself. I don't know if anybody else feels this too. I don't know if you feel this, but I have a hard time reading for pleasure now. Mm-hmm. Now that I do the writing work, mm-hmm. I find in the first couple chapters I'm like nitpicking it apart, like, oh, why did they do this? Why did that? And I had to like kind of like just plow through it in order to get into the heart of the story and forget about doing that. Like, I don't know how to flip that conscious switch in my head to turn that off.
Yeah. I wish I had a way to tell you, like, this is how you flip the switch.
Yeah. I wish you did too.
but I do have to be very conscientious about it. And that's something I realized. I was reading almost all nonfiction outside of children's books. And I had to be like, I'm just going to read for fun. I'm going to read things mm-hmm. outside of the scope of what I would normally read. And so I do have to be mindful about that and just choose to focus on the story versus focusing mm-hmm. on the words. And
yeah, for me, I have to like read faster, like get my brain past the individual words and just get into the story. Just go through it. Just read really fast, and then you can. Eventually, it slips away, and you get into the story. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. the curse of being a writer and a reader.
Yeah, for me, the thing that makes it the most difficult for me to immerse into a story is when there's multiple points of view. Like, I tend to prefer a single point of view story really in any book. Like, I like to
don't
be
read
in
my
that
book.
Person's
my book has two point of views.
Brain or body, and just kind of like consume myself into that world. Mm-hmm. And when you're switching points of view, like, you're no longer, I feel like I'm switching bodies and I have to like reorient myself mm-hmm. to the same body. It can be worth it, right? Like, it can be worth it in a really good story. The two that come to mind is Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age is a super fascinating book. And actually, the main character of the book is a book. That's all I'm going to tell you.
That's awesome.
Without it being a spoiler, it's a little bit of a spoiler because you don't realize that till a long way in.
Sorry, readers.
But not really. It's totally worth reading. But my husband actually, my now husband, gave it to me on our second date. And
that's a good sign.
I was very motivated to read it because this was this new guy I was dating and he gave me this book, but it was like, I think it took me 3 or 4 months to get through the first 100 pages because it kept switching points of view. And then after that, I finished the last 300 pages in a weekend because it was just all those pieces came together enough mm-hmm. that I was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And the same thing with The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood. She kept switching between points of view. And I was just like, what are you even doing? And same thing, about 100 pages in. And that now I was like able to body switch more seamlessly. And I was like, and it was all the way up to the very end with both of those books. You're just like, you don't even know what's going to happen until you're like in the last chapter. And then like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that was the thing the whole time. So, yeah.
We probably should start wrapping this up. We're nearing our hour mark, but I had two more questions I wanted to get through.
Okay. Let's go for it.
How do you deal with negativity in the writer's life? How do you deal with any negative feedback you might get from your own writing? How does your brain deal with that?
From myself or from other people? Or both?
Either one.
So I feel like I deal with criticism from other people better because I'm able to take it more objectively. And it usually is more objective. It's usually more valid. Like, the criticism I give to myself usually is completely invalid. It's usually when I'm about two-thirds
of the
way.
We're our own worst critics.
Yes. It's usually when I'm about two-thirds of the way through a project and I've read the same words 100 times. And I'm just like, it's terrible. Everything's terrible. I'm terrible. Why do I even think I can do this?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And in that case, you know, it's just kind of feeling out. Sometimes I need to just take a break from it for a day or two, and that'll give me enough of a perspective mm-hmm. to come back. And sometimes I just have to force myself to keep going, to keep pushing through and being like, if it's terrible, I can come back and fix it later.
That's what editing's
for. I just have
to
keep going. Right, exactly. So it just depends on like how severe, you know, if somebody else has something to say about my writing, first of all, I definitely consider the source because, you know, the advice that I always give to other people, whether it be writing or otherwise, you know, are, if they are not someone who's already done what you want to do successfully, or are your ideal client or reader, then what they say doesn't really have any impact.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. If they're not someone like better than you giving you advice, or if they're like, if they're not your market, then why? Yeah. That's good advice.
You know, because even if they're a writer, right? If they, you know, for someone who never reads children's books, if they only read, you know, science fiction or horror fiction or fan, like what they have to say to me about what they think about my children's book is not really very valid because it's a different style of writing. So I will just politely thank them for their thoughts and move on. You know, if it is somebody who is in one of those two groups, you know, then I want to take it into account and say,
right, because maybe they're seeing something you're not seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And say, is this valid? But I don't necessarily automatically assume I have to do what they said to fix it. Because they may be able to identify a problem, but that does not always mean they can identify the solution. I'll consider their solution if they said, oh, you should write it this way. But oftentimes, and even, you know, with an editor, like they might say, rewrite it this way. And I'll say, okay, well, I meant this. They perceived that. I don't really like their solution for how to fix it because it doesn't really get to what I was trying to get at.
Right.
But then I can find some third way or fourth way or fifth way to say it that, you know, helps me see how what I'm doing is being read. Margaret Atwood actually said very interestingly that writing is one of the few creative pursuits that is not completed by the writer but by the reader, because they're creating the finished product in their head as they're reading. And so
interesting.
I've always found that kind of interesting. I definitely see readers as a co-creator of the world. So I want to make sure that they're seeing what my intention is. So if they aren't getting what I meant to write out of it, I feel like it's silly to be like, well, that's not what I meant. You just don't get it. And be like, okay, well, if they didn't get it, then I need to explain it better.
Right.
We need to try something different. So
that sounds like excellent advice. And my last question before we can wrap this up and let you go back to your kids is, how do people in your life support you as a writer?
Different people support me in different ways, depending on what they bring to the table. You know, there are people who are writers in my life that I can get that kind of real advice from. There are people who have no idea, like don't understand what I do at all, who are just very encouraging. Who buy my books.
It sounds like my husband, but
I mean, that's always exciting. I had one friend that she bought the Ducky book, and she bought my COVID-19 coloring book, and she wanted me to sign them, and I was very flattered by that. She's like, someday you're going to be really famous and these will be worth a lot of money. I was like, okay. I'll accept that. You know, but honestly, I feel like my biggest supporters are my kids. Like, I love reading to them. I love seeing and hearing their reactions to what I read to them, whether it's my writing or not. And, you know, they're just such an encouraging force in my life. Just saying, that was really cool, Mom. Or it was my, even not areas just related to my writing, but like my 12-year-old yesterday, he's like, the 2-year-old and I fell asleep on the couch. He goes, you two were just so adorable. I wish I could have taken a picture.
That's super cute. Really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. That totally adorable. Let's wrap this up. Okay. So before we go, tell me, what's your writing excuse? Why are you not writing today? Tongue in cheek or truthful? Your choice.
You know, it's usually because I make excuses that I have other things that I need to do. And I've really just found, like, this is my mantra. I am a writer and writers write. That whenever I find myself like being like, oh, I have to go switch the laundry or do the dishes or like deal with this client thing over here, I am a writer and writers write. So if I'm a writer, that's what I need to go do. But that's the thing that's always fighting is the attention for my time.
Is the other stuff in the house.
Yes.
I understand this in 100% entirety. Yes.
all the other demands. So I should really like write that and frame it somewhere. I'm a writer and writers write.
Like post-it note that's constantly right in front of your face, like on a stick. Like,
yes.
You're supposed to be writing. Go write.
Exactly. Exactly.
What do you think, readers and writers? What's your writing excuse? Let me know on Twitter at RNW Podcast or on Instagram, Read and Write Podcast. If you're interested in any of the books we mentioned, I'm going to put them in the show notes for you. And we are going to go on a hunt and try to find Rivka's book for her.
That would be fantastic.
I know. We'll find it. We will. Even if I have to spend all winter doing it. And don't forget, you can find her on Facebook and Instagram at Meet Rivka. Join me next Wednesday when I'm going to talk to Danelle Lejeune about old dead projects. Until then, keep reading, keep writing, and go do what you do best. You got this. And that's it. Thank you for listening to the show. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to rate Read and Write on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, drop me a line. I'm always open to suggestions. Also, did you know that Read and Write publishes 3 episodes a week? Check out the podcast's YouTube channel for Write With Me Mondays live streams and 30-second book reviews on Fridays.